Welcome to this 19-part series of Business Podcasts by David Maister, exploring the key principles and practices found in his new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this series of podcasts, I'm proud to present a special 19-part series of the audiobook version of my new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of the book in hardback, it is now available from both Amazon.com and at my website at davidmaister.com/store. This is Chapter 15 of my book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, The One Firm Firm Revisited. In 1985, I wrote an article for the Sloan Management Review called The One Firm Firm, which identified a strategy common to leading firms across a broad array of professions, creating institutional loyalty and team focus. They seem to apply to many of the principles I advocated then, and now. The firms named in that article were McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, Arthur Andersen, Hewitt Associates, and the law firm of Latham & Watkins. If you're prepared to accept the argument that Accenture, formerly Andersen Consulting, is the legacy firm of Arthur Andersen, and not the now-defunct audit-based business, then that 1985 list of one-firm firms stacks up remarkably well as a predictor of subsequent success. These are still preeminent and immensely successful firms. In this article, or podcast, co-authored with Jack Walker, formerly the managing partner of Latham & Watkins, I revisit the actions and performance of these widely admired firms. The marketplace for professional firms has changed in ways that were unimaginable in 1985. Clients and client relationships have become dynamic at best and fickle at worst. Shortages and mobility of talent have affected every profession. As a result, the five named firms and their main competitors have adapted by making dramatic and often risky changes. For example, of those five firms, Goldman, Accenture, and Hewitt have become publicly held companies. Most have acquired other firms with varying degrees of success, and all have grown, become global, and, except perhaps in the case of McKinsey, have profoundly diversified their service offerings. Yet each has maintained or improved its competitive position as one of the most admired and profitable firms in its industry or profession. This chapter or podcast addresses the issue of whether the one-firm firm principles identified in 1985 are still relevant to the continued success of these five firms. It focuses on what's been maintained, adapted, and abandoned in their management since 1985. As we shall see, one-firm firm principles do indeed continue to drive success for these firms, even as their specific practices have been adapted and modified for changing market conditions. The one-firm firm approach is not simply a loose term to describe a culture. It refers to a set of concrete management practices consciously chosen to maximize the trust and loyalty that members of the firm feel both to the institution and to each other. In 1985, the elements of the one-firm firm approach were given as highly selective recruitment, a grow-your-own people strategy, as opposed to heavy use of lateral hires, growing only as fast as people could be developed and assimilated, intensive use of training as a socialization process, a rejection of the star system and its related individualistic behavior, avoidance of mergers in order to sustain the collaborative culture, selective choices of services and marketers so as to win through significant investments in focused areas rather than many small initiatives. Active outplacement and alumni management so that those who leave remain loyal to the firm. Compensation based mostly on group performance, not individual performance. High investments in research and development. An extensive intra-firm communication with broad use of consensus-building approaches. The one-firm firm approach is similar in many ways to the U.S. Marine Corps, in which Jack Walker served. Both are designed to achieve the highest levels of internal collaboration and encourage mutual commitment to pursuing ambitious goals. Marines have a special bond and a shared pride, built on shared values and a shared striving for excellence with integrity. Every Marine grasps the concept of stewardship. The organization, its reputation, and its very effectiveness have been inherited from previous generations and are held in trust for future generations. Marines are noted for acting as a cohesive unit rather than as individual members. Each Marine honors the Corps' traditions: unity, pride, respect, loyalty, excellence, and integrity. The key relationship is that of the individual member to the organization, in the form of a set of reciprocal values-based expectations. This in turn informs and supports relationships among members who may not even know each other personally. Everyone knows the values he or she must live by and the code of behavior he or she must follow. Everyone is commonly and intensively trained in these values and protocols. Everyone also knows that if an individual is in trouble, the group will expend every effort to help him or her. A contrasting and more common approach to running a professional service firm is the star-based or warlord concept, which succeeds by emphasizing internal competition, individual entrepreneurialism, distinct profit centers, decentralized decision-making, and the strength that comes from stimulating many diverse initiatives driven by relatively autonomous operators. In extreme warlord firms, the productive senior members operate as chieftains, presiding over their own territories, occasionally collaborating, but generally acting without a long-run commitment to the institution or each other. Many prosperous firms who do prefer the warlord model succeed by replacing institutional energy with the sum of individual entrepreneurial energies. They forego institutional commitment and collaboration in favor of attracting and retaining the most successful warlords. Warlord firms succeed when management keeps the big hitters happy and productive. The past and the future are not often items high on the agenda of such firms. Consequently, over time, the performance of extreme warlord firms often swings through peaks and valleys. Much management energy is expended in modulating the politically charged environment. Personal taste can play an important role in determining which path a firm takes. Some of the most effective professionals cannot abide by the one firm firm model, and they do thrive in the warlord model, and vice versa. Most firms are neither pure one-firm firms nor pure warlord firms. What the two extremes have in common is a high level of energy. Firms in the middle may pay a price if they fail to engage either the high levels of internal collaboration or high levels of entrepreneurial individualism. Capturing the benefits of high institutional energy is not easy. The one-firm firm system, like that of the Marine Corps, depends upon a mutually reinforcing set of concrete policies and practices, and many firms may not be able to get from here to there in a short period of time. True one-firm firms are, and will likely remain, statistical anomalies in each of their professions or industry, albeit very successful ones. If one were to focus primarily on their range of services and locations, the five one-firm firms are now almost unrecognizable compared to what they were in 1985. Goldman now emphasizes proprietary trading, a change from its predominantly advisory roots. Hewitt and Accenture have moved into business processing outsourcing, and both McKinsey and Latham have expanded their service offerings and global coverage. As mentioned, Accenture, Hewitt, and Goldman have become public companies. According to most press reports, McKinsey experimented with some significant changes as the consulting industry felt the impact of technology. An early countercultural attempt to acquire and integrate an IT firm was generally considered to be a failure. In the late 1990s, the technology bubble led the firm to expand at a faster pace, rapidly increasing the rate of hiring new juniors. The firm opened offices in many more locations around the world and reportedly cut back on training. As did other professional firms in that era, McKinsey stretched its compensation system to pay stars more in order to keep them. Then, when the bubble burst, the relative economics dropped, and according to media reports, the firm had to downsize, issuing a capital call on its partners. However, according to most reports, the new managing partner who took over in 2003 has reoriented the firm to a more values-driven, one-firm-firm approach. Goldman Sachs has also been through significant policy and cultural change, particularly during the late 1990s, leading up to the decision to go public. As with much of Wall Street, the traditional reliance on long-term relationships to build the firm has been significantly influenced by a move towards a transactional approach, pursuing fast-moving market opportunities. Nevertheless, most observers would concede that Goldman is still, by far, the most collaborative team-based banking firm. Latham has also stretched the boundaries of the one-firm-firm approach. Like most of the others, it has relied on an increased use of laterals. It has also introduced a greater individual component into its reward scheme, and it has acquired some sizable groups over the course of its expansion, adding, for example, a firm of more than 90 lawyers in France in 2001. Hewitt has also experienced dramatic changes. A few years ago, it acquired a large firm that was difficult to integrate. It's gone public and has shifted from being mainly an advisory firm to being primarily a human resources business process outsourcing. Hewitt often acquires the client's HR department in order to do this, which is contrary to the one-firm-firm approach of stringent selective recruiting from the bottom. Accenture has also migrated to the profoundly different business of outsourcing, along with less stringent hiring practices. Despite these changes, most of the one-firm firms have retained their commitment to teamwork and collaboration rather than to individual entrepreneurialism. This is most clearly revealed in their special human resource practices designed to enforce high standards of both teamwork and dynamism. The April 29, 2006 issue of The Economist contains an article profiling Goldman Sachs with rich details about its intensive and selective hiring and promotion processes and the enforcement of high standards even amongst the firm's most senior people. The article says, "Often enough, someone important is asked to leave. This is one of Paulson's most critical roles." Then CEO Hank Paulson later became U.S. Treasury Secretary. Paulson is quoted as saying, "Goldman is a hard place to be hired, a hard place to be promoted, and a hard place to stay." One of The Economist writers observes, "If you want an explanation of how Goldman endures, that perhaps is the best explanation of all." What these firms teach us is that the essence of the one-firm-firm strategy and what gives it its economic power is not a superior ability to select markets and services, but a greater ability to achieve high standards through the consistent application and enforcement of espoused operating rules, philosophies, values, and ideologies. A key component in a successful one-firm-firm is the governance structure. Members of the firm must feel they have approved the leaders and that the leaders are accountable to them. This is normally accomplished by members electing the head of the firm, who then serve for a term, typically renewable by election. In most cases, the leader is supported by a small, elected, term-limited management committee comprised of practicing professionals. This accountability is usually balanced by a structure that insulates the leadership from the wrath of colleagues following tough decisions that may involve short-term unpleasantness for long-term gain. Because one-firm firms are driven by a commonly held ideology, once all viewpoints are aired and management makes its decision, the partners generally support that decision. Partners or senior officers are willing to delegate managerial powers upward because they trust that those appointed to leadership will operate in accordance with the known principles and values of the firm's ideology. The existence of shared values underpins sustained management effectiveness. Maintaining this environment requires active management effort and usually careful thought in the appointment of group leaders. Running on autopilot is not an option. Peter Friedes, the former CEO of Hewitt Associates, said, "I had 15 or so managers reporting to me. I needed them not to be pulling the firm in different directions. One practice I had was to remind all those who reported to me that part of their role was to have my CEO perspective in managing their group. They were not just to be an advocate for their group or their people. They had to have a whole entity view. The payoff from this consensus values-based management practice can be huge. It permits the firm to excel at getting things done as a firm. Partners in warlord firms typically continue to undermine decisions they dislike, since they feel they have not delegated the power to management to make those decisions. Now, this doesn't mean that one firm partners are shy about expressing themselves or opposing management as issues arise. They do, but more safely and effectively than in warlord firms, where political risk and retribution are real issues. It's very difficult to sustain the one firm consensus-based governance system as the firm grows beyond the point where all members know each other. The good news is if many, if not most, powerful professionals yearn to be part of a cohesive team, often in spite of their chest-thumping behavior. This yearning is something that can be leveraged. As clients and competitors change and as firms grow and expand, management must work harder to hold the firm together by, among other things, engendering a sense of reciprocal obligation both between the firm and individual members and among the members. While 20 years ago a firm could engage in broad consultation and give people a real sense of participation, today's mega-large one-firm firms cannot feasibly do this without great effort and creativity. Inevitably, the top person becomes more CEO-like. This has happened at each of the national firms. This predictable transition from consensus building to a consult-then-decide approach can, in fact, be successfully accomplished only when built upon the one firm's traditional, strong, and long-established philosophical base of shared values. In a sense, the trust given to the firm-wide, often global CEO is a residual habit left over from times when the CEO was universally known and approachable. If the chief executive is to enjoy the same latitude to manage as in the past, then his or her character, values, and principles all become even more important. And of course, he or she must continue to deliver. Shared values go only so far. A core characteristic of the one firm is the careful hiring, training, and indoctrination of new talent. In 1985, the one firms relied almost exclusively on hiring from the bottom. They resisted lateral hiring as unnecessary and risky to the firm's fabric. But as mentioned, things have changed dramatically. One key feature still common to most one-firm firms is that the core, if no longer exclusive strategy, is to grow their own young talent. Professionals hired directly from school invariably have the strongest emotional ties to each other and to the firm, and they are the ones who find it hardest to abandon ship. Another advantage of focusing on young hires is a nimble, energetic group of people who are generally more willing to embrace the core teamwork culture and the core values than are older lateral hires. Many warlord firms have reduced or eliminated entry-level recruiting, purportedly because of the short-term cost of hiring and training such people. They prefer to save on training costs by hiring experienced lateral people from other firms. Such firms are sending two uncongenial messages. The people we hire are fungible, and there is nothing special about us. As a result, they fail to develop the loyalty and cohesiveness needed during periods of both prosperity and stress. One of the keys to the one firm model is the vigorous enforcement of high standards for progression within the firm. This means that a relatively small percentage of those hired are actually promoted through the ranks. For that reason, the rates of nominal turnover in one firms may not differ from those of other firms. However, one of the hallmarks of the model is that the people who leave one firms do so with great pride and loyalty, often become a source of business referrals for the firm. Turnover amongst junior and even senior people has become a fact of life in all professions. In the 1980s, Latham learned that it made all the difference in the world whether people left feeling neglected or badly treated or as proud advocates of the firm. Up to that point, Latham had ferociously concentrated on hiring, training, indoctrinating, and holding on to talent. In that environment, a lawyer leaving the firm to do something else was regarded as a failure rather than as an opportunity. The pejorative term attrition was applied to these sad events. As a result, the firm often treated the departing lawyer as if he or she was a defector. In retrospect, the firm lost millions of dollars in potential business because it mismanaged relationships with those who left. As Latham matured as an organization, it changed its practices to honor and cultivate the friendship of the people who left the firm. In the mid-1990s, Latham calculated how much of then-current business came directly or indirectly from alums. The figure was approaching 50%, and it was great business. Name brand clients, often premium rates, quicker bill collection, pleasant dealings, and so on. Moreover, the clients benefited because the alums had a special feeling for the firm, including the knowledge of its strengths and weaknesses. In some cases, alternative risk-reward billing arrangements could be worked out because of the built-in trust factor. At all of the one-firm firms, the loyalty of alumni is a key competitive weapon. A leader in one-firm firm said, "One of the managing partners of a competing firm came to me and said, 'The thing that strikes fear in our hearts is when one of your alums ends up as one of our clients. The loyalty is beyond our understanding and usually means it's just a matter of time before you guys have your nose under the tent.'" Prior to the 1980s, firms entered new markets cautiously by redeploying existing talent. But affairs and clients began to move quickly, and markets have shifted much more rapidly in the years since then. Accordingly, most of the one-firm firms have expanded their use of lateral experience hires. To wait for inside talent to develop was to risk missing the boat. In addition, firms in every profession started to open offices in new geographic markets. Early attempts to staff new offices solely with partners from existing offices were unsuccessful. As a result, expanding firms began to cherry-pick talented, experienced people from outside the firm. Most firms move cautiously, bringing in only individuals and small groups, and avoiding large-scale mergers. The key has been to make sure that when new laterals join the firm, they know what they are buying into. The lateral must understand that he or she is joining a firm with an established ideology. If you don't like this ideology, the clear message is sent, don't think of joining us. Surprising to many outsiders, one-firm firms have found that many laterals come to the firm to benefit from good management, that is, to be managed. They know about the firm's reputation for effective management and team-based approaches, and they often come from poorly run firms. Often, not always, they are the most fervent supporters of teamwork, management, and cohesive action in their new organization. Lateral hiring, now a competitive necessity, remains a double-edged sword, however, for a one-firm firm. On the one hand, careful lateral hiring provides rich work opportunities for the homegrowns. Also, laterals can help the firm challenge its settled view of itself. Done well, laterals can bring an air of dynamism and creativity to a firm. On the other hand, lateral hiring is management intensive. The bottom line is that a disciplined lateral program, anathema not long ago, can strengthen a one-firm firm. A poorly managed program with people coming from all sorts of foreign destinations can have a tendency to pull the firm apart. The one-firm firms have largely avoided the stampede towards individually based or profit-center-based reward schemes. However, since 1985, most one-firm firms have gradually expanded the individual component of their reward scheme, in fact, if not in rhetoric, and have increased the total compensation ratio between the highest paid members and the lowest paid members. At Latham, until 1993, the long-term compensation was essentially lockstep, driven mainly by seniority. Under cover of the early 1990s recession, this system was changed. Management's considered view was that the firm could not operate successfully in the emerging marketplace without providing more incentive for short and long-term individual performance, particularly on the business development front. Jack Walker reports that this was the hardest decision he had to make during his tenure as managing partner because of the obvious risk to the firm's fabric. But because the firm was sold and accepted as fundamentally respectful of the firm's ideology and shared values, not as a scuttling of them, It turned out to be a successful move. Since that change, the percentage of Latham Partners hustling and producing business or business of substance has dramatically grown. Most one-firm firms run judgment-based compensation schemes with a studied avoidance of formulas. As always, the key to successful functioning of the system is agreement on values and ideology. This is because a successful compensation scheme requires trust. The partners must believe that the compensation decisions are made by colleagues who have the firm's best interests as their only agenda. There are many reasons why institutional trust and loyalty are important in professional businesses, but three are worth stressing immediately. First, clients of a one-firm firm have, as a practical matter, access to all the resources of a firm. Individual members, rewarded through the overall success of the enterprise, are more comfortable bringing in other parts of the firm to both win and serve clients with complex, multidisciplinary or multi-jurisdictional matters. Clients are generally better served than they would be by a firm of solos or silos. Clients respond positively when individual members support and especially do not undermine their colleagues. One-firm firms are good at both internal and external relationships. In firms that emphasize the use of credit and compensation systems to motivate and placate individual members, client service across disciplines and geography will often suffer. Sophisticated clients may cherry-pick great individual professionals or small practice teams from such firms, but will rarely depend on them for complex work across boundaries. Warlord firms like this tend to excel at transactions, but not relationships across boundaries. Second, as we have seen, the stewardship approach that one-firm firms take towards their recruits, selectivity, training, high standards, when done well, can lead to great alumni loyalty. One-firm firms do not necessarily have lower levels of turnover, but former employees often lead as loyal advocates of the firm because of the way they were treated when they were there. Employees of warlord firms do not always feel this way. This can have a significant impact on future revenues. Third, trust and loyalty give a professional service firm a better chance of surviving market downturns. The test of a firm is not how it does in good times, but how it responds to roadblocks, stumbles, and both major and minor problems. On such inevitable occasions, members of a loyalty-based firm will pull together, and they will take pride and pleasure in doing so. In professional businesses with a free agent climate, seemingly successful firms can and have disintegrated almost overnight. At the first sign of weakness, the strongest members of free agent firms often feel that the sensible personal strategy is to build and cling to their personal client base and reputation. At the very time when leadership is most needed, it is difficult to get the best people to work for the good of the firm. As firms grow weaker, the key members clutch ever more tightly to their own client work and the firm flounders. Those who can run for the door. It is not easy to reverse this spiral. Many professional firms are currently engaging in activities that undermine loyalty and create fault lines, including growing for growth's sake by incoherently adding laterals and mergers, expanding into unconnected practice areas and markets, hiring primarily semi-experienced lateral associates rather than hiring and training entry-level applicants, eliminating social and partner officer meetings as a cost-cutting measure, pulling up the ladder to partner or owner status and establishing complex membership hierarchies, including non-equity levels, not to serve clients, but to relieve inside pain, obsessing about short-term bottom line, treating financial success as the goal rather than as the byproduct of a well-run firm. Joseph Hyerson offers an interesting explanation of why such actions are common. Consider, he says, looking at the issue from the perspective of a powerful rainmaker in a professional service firm. The bottom line question is whether a rainmaker is better off supporting a warlord model and developing a strong portable practice that can be moved to another firm if the current firm gets into trouble. He notes that while many firms have gone under in downturns, few rainmakers have. Hyerson's special insight is that firms compete not only for clients and junior staff, but also for rainmakers. And much of what we can see in the evolution of firms can best be understood in terms of that competition. This reasoning may indeed explain why some warlord firms, if staffed with truly skilled warlords, do well, at least in the short run. Brian Summer, a former Accenture partner, points out on his blog, www.servicessafari.com, in a posting called The Lessons of Anderson, that too much individual incentive could lead firms into trouble in boom times as well as bad times. He says, great firms don't let their partners sell inappropriate work. They have quality control processes that prevent this. They utilize partners from different geographies, industries, etc., to do these quality control checks so that no one in a position of career determination can influence whether the work is sold and how it is structured. Great firms have a formalized approval process. Great firms protect their reputation as they realize that their brand is their number one asset. Great firms also pay all people in a relatively uniform way. Lone wolf selling and delivery to get the biggest pile of money at the end of the year drives way too many bad deals. Jonathan Nee, in a review of his experience working in investment banking in a book called The Accidental Investment Banker, also points out that temptations can exist when a boom market allows firms to achieve rapid volume increases by relaxing their hiring or other quality standards. Management must be disciplined, must know how to say no in prosperous times as well as in downtimes. Our observation from watching one-firm firms over 20 years confirms Nee's observations. In highly prosperous periods, productive partners grow impatient with management's reluctance, for example, to hire hastily in order to staff all their new production or to promote their favorite busiest partner candidates. In busy times, there's also a temptation to let investments such as training take a back seat to getting the work out the door. Only adherence to the firm's principles and values prevents opportunistic behavior that may have short-term benefits but long-term adverse consequences. Rainmakers, who are always stressed, or even more so in boom times, often have little patience with the one-firm firm business disciplines. They are characteristically insecure about whether it will rain tomorrow for them. This insecurity compels them to hustle for new business. They are also likely to compare their compensation with that of the leading rainmakers in warlord firms. When they feel that they are not at the top of their peer group, they often find it hard to trust in the future. This is especially true of members who did not grow up in the firm. It takes time to develop both loyalty and the long-term view. Managers of one-firm firms earn their money during these times. It is tempting to relax the disciplines in boom times, but boom times always recede, and the bad calls always come back to haunt us. As we have tried to report, the five named one-firm firms are both similar to and different from what they were in 1985. Changes have happened in these firms, but they have been managed within a mostly coherent ideological framework. Some specific one-firm firm practices have changed with positive effect, and some experimental moves away from the one-firm firm system were mistakes. These firms may appear to lack the pure commitment to the ideals described in 1985, but they are still distinguished by their deep commitment to a teamwork approach. So it may be fair to say that the 1985 profile of the one-firm firms left out one important item: flexibility and the willingness to experiment and change within the firm's value system. One-firm firms are known for their attention to what warlord firms would pejoratively characterize as soft values. If our experience since 1985 tells us anything, it is that this attention, balanced of course with high standards, can really pay off in terms of producing the kind of internal loyalties and energy necessary for long-term success. This concludes this chapter of my book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in ordering a copy of the book in its printed form, visit Amazon.com or my website at davidmaester.com/store.